Mr. Robinson, Reel 3. I'd like now to ask you, you decided to volunteer. How did you go about doing it? This would be around about June, July 1943, I think.
That's right, yeah.
How did you get it, go about it?
Well, I had to, you had to go along to the to a labour exchange or an RAF recruiting office that does this sort of thing. And the nearest one to where we live, I don't know it, was in Acton, in North Acton. And I wandered along there one morning. I think I saw my parents and I said, I'm going to volunteer, and they were a bit upset about this, but they probably thought, well, this is a volunteer, nothing will happen, you know. And so I went along. And I went and see them in close, nothing like an ATC uniform. I walked in there and I saw the chapel on.
Now, was this a labour exchange, or this was the actual recruiting office, right? Sorry, you were saying you were
a chap with the, was a corporal, I think, in the so I wanted to join the one forms of therapy for the RAF. So I said, no, you mean the ATC, then you're not old enough for the RAF. Is that? He said, no, no, you want the ATC training corps. No, they're just down the road here. I said, no, I'm from the RAF, I'm the age to volunteer. So he said, are you sure? And I said, well, I am sure, you know him. So he said, I looked about 12 years old from him. And anyway, he gave me a form to fill in, and he showed me a form where he had an example by the side of how to fill it in. And he said, you fill your name and the names in, that goes out there, but don't put the same names in, they put down there. So I said, well, I do understand that, really. You want my details? I filled it all in, and he said, well, we'll let you know. And you have to be called up for a medical, and some tests, psychological tests, and all this sort of stuff. And about a week later, I had this request to go to a building in Euston Road, which I think used to be the headquarters of the Royal Aero Club many years ago, but it was taken over as an RAF aircrew centre. And so I went from it was going to be a two-day medical. I had to have a medical first, an ordinary medical. I was going to the local medical centre and have an ordinary medical. I thought, past that, now I could go to the aircrew medical. So I went along to this aircrew medical, and there were lots of people moving around the world, place in this big building. And they said, first of all, we're going to give you some medical tests, and then we'll give you some psychological tests and others, and interviews and this sort of stuff, and we'll go back to medical again.
Now, what were they looking for in the medical? What was special about it?
Well, they wanted people that were absolutely nothing wrong with them. That eyesight, hearing, physically capable, and absolutely no background of any serious things, this sort of stuff. Because they also used to claim that the RAF air crew were the fittest men in the world stuff, and so therefore they didn't make sure they fit people, so they thought fitted into that category. Well, I had a medical test, so they told you nothing as you went along, except that if you failed, they say, well, there's a railway ticket to go home, and thanks very much for calling. They wouldn't tell you what was wrong, they weren't allowed to do that, because you go see your doctor, and they'll tell you what's wrong, and this sort of stuff. So I gradually made my way through the various cubicles that existed for them.
Now, what about the tests, the psychological tests, or whatever,
the
mental?
Took place the next day, actually. The first day was mostly all medical. Then the next day was a bit more medical, but just the last bits of it. And then the...
Now, you passed the medical, I presume?
Well, apparently so. I said nothing, so when I was seeing that it was all right. I kept asking, how have I got on? That's also right. I'm going to be... This sort of thing, and I kept it a secret. But if he was diverted into another corridor, you knew that was the way out. And so I did all these tests, which were pattern tests, a lot of them where you compare backwards, this sort of thing, or you have a sequence of numbers, and what's the next two numbers, and which shape looks like that shape, all this sort of stuff on paper.
They sound like sort of simple IQ or intelligence tests, yes.
It only worked, very, very basic stuff. And I found out most of the time that the pattern tests were, if you were wallpaper and hanger, you could pass them every time because you had to match patterns, but that's by the way. And they did all this stuff. And then you had interviews with various people who asked all sorts of strange things. Now, and the big thing I was always told by a friend of mine who had been through this is whatever you have, whatever they say to you, you stick to your boundaries, you want to be airproof. Don't, if they try and say you'd be much better doing this sort of thing, so you don't worry, you're not interested, you must be airproof. So I call this in mind all the way through.
Do you remember the sort of thing they're asking you? I mean, it's a long time ago, but roughly.
I think they were asking about interests, why in the IAF, why have you chosen this, why a Warris operator in my case, why do you want to be here? But in those days it was a Warris operator air gunner, that was dropped later on, the air gunner thing. It's things like, why do you particularly want to be, why don't you want to be a pilot, why don't you be a navigator, why do you want to be this sort of thing, and to try and not put you off, but to make sure this is what you're really, you weren't just saying it for the time of it. And also in the background, they delve into that in a lot of detail, really, and the scores and all that. They said that, something I never found out, that being going to the selective central school, as it was called, that was something special. They said, well, put that down, that's very important. And any form is something, oh, it's quite special. Well, it's better than all these centres and what they know, whether it is or not, I really don't know, but that's what I was told at the time. And they kept virtually querying, cross-checking everything that was said to make sure that you know, just made it up on the spot and knew the script, so to speak. And at the end of all that, I saw a good captain who he said, what about aircraft recognition? I mean, he said, what about aircraft recognition? That's one thing we do at the ATC, and I forgot to mention. So I said, well, okay, so if I show you some pictures, can you tell me what they are? I said, well, okay, yeah. So he flashed these cards at me, Spitfire, Hurricane, Wellington, and all this sort of stuff, and Silhouettes as well as pictures. And that was one thing I was quite good at in those days. And, you know, there wasn't all that many variations of aircraft that we had to make too much of a difference. And suddenly he shot a few American aircraft at me, which I must have been sort of in the show anyway. And so I said, well, it's nice. So you're quite good on that. He said, well, listen, I'm afraid. I don't think there'll be silver for aircraft. So I said, why is that? He said, well, he said, it's your size. But what we call under physical development. So what do you mean by that? So he said, it means you've got to be, everybody's physically suitable for certain jobs. And, I'm not going to handle heavy aircraft when I'm sitting in the back there, or in the middle, wherever it is. They might get there. And I said, anyway, I'm sure with a year in the first year, I'll probably have enough weight to bring me up to size. I'm still growing. So he said, oh, I'm sorry, I said, but I think there's a bit of a put off, really. You know, I think he was trying to stick to the guns. So he said, well, I think you'd be much more suitable on the ground job. And he said, you're sitting here while I was operating on the ground, that was the thing. So no, it's got to be electrical. So he said, yeah, I'm really sure about that, this sort of conversation. So I said, well, I am absolutely sure it's going to be that. So he said, well, all right, so I've put you forward. So don't forget, so you've got to pull on this way, you can be at any time, we can even say to you, if you're not up to the medical standard, you can be taken off the course. So okay, fine. Well, as I was 7:74, I thought, well, I'm about 10 now, but 7:74, then it's a bit lightweight, really, and I knew that, of course, and I thought, well, how am I going to do the physical, the stuff that's going to be demanded of me? And as it turned out, in the first year, I went up to 10 stone. And that was with exercise, which I've never had much before. That's with the those stuffy food, which was the balanced food and all that, but I changed dramatically in the first year. I got over that hurdle.
So he said yes, basically. Yes, what happened then? This is the 2 days.
What happened? He said, then we'll get, unfortunately, because so many people channeling through, You might have to be on deferred service. In private service, 6 months deferred service. In Post Navigator and Bombers, which was the same group, they were 6 months deferred service. So I think it was there about 4 months in the beginning of November, which is how it turned out.
So you stayed on at work?
Stayed on at work. I told them at work. I accepted that. I got 4 months.
How did they react?
They didn't believe me. Really. They said, one of the strange things was when I came out, I was so pleased that in Post, If you could wear a white flash in your forage cap, the aircrew didn't wear that to say the old insignia. The aircrew on the train, so I went across the shelf, across the road in Houston, and where they were selling all this sort of stuff, badges, and I said, I want a white flash in my cap. They said, for a friend of yours, it's no speak. And the lady going, what do you yourselves, all these big chaps coming here telling me that they failed the test, and you can accept it for airport your size. I said, what size do you do with it? Anyway, so I wore this white flash. No one believed it. They thought, yeah, they were called in there. Are you sure? Tell us the story. And I had to try and persuade them what was happening. Because they couldn't know. Well, you saw a picture, you realised that.
So you carried on with the ATC in that?
Well, that's right.
Well, we might as well pick that up. How had they trained you in aircraft recognition? How did they go about it?
Mostly projecting slides on or picture, not slides in those days, but pictures on the wall with an old type projector and giving on for a few seconds and taking it off and asking us to do it. As it turned out later on, it's a thousandth of a second one has to recognise it. And it can be done because of the after image. You didn't realise that at the time, but the after image keeps on a bit longer.
Obviously, did they have sort of a guide to aircraft types, you know, like the James Book of...
That's right, very similar. Yeah, there were all sorts of books on the aircraft image. I had several of them actually, and they were all virtually the same pictures in them. Maybe someone came out, I thought that and cost about 6 months or something at the time, but I thought it was. Might help them to an angle or something, but they're very important to know one from the other.
And would you practice? I mean, if a bomber came across us,
anything, whatever aircraft. When my uncle, for instance, next door, said there's a German bomber coming, I'd like to come down, that's a strip fire, actually. So it was quite difficult. It was one of those things where, it was a natural thing, aircraft recognition became in the Air Force on the ATC.
Now, what did your parents think when you turned up with this white flash and told them that you were going?
I think they didn't say so, but they were pleased for my sake, which I was saying, that I got the moment, if that's what you want to do, fine. They're a bit upset from their point of view, and I'm sure they were. They never said so, never discussed it.
Were you aware of the level of, I mean, by then, that's mid-43, the casualties in Bomber Command?
Well, I think what we were told, which wasn't the real facts as it turned out. I mean, if you thought of, for instance, 20 planes shot down, it never sort of crossed your mind instantly, but it might be 160 people involved, say 8 in a crew or 6 in a crew or whatever. You know, there might be a lot more people involved. You never crossed your mind that, for instance, you were dropping bombs on in factories, perhaps, later on, and there might be people in the factories. You know, those sort of things. But
So you were waiting for this. How long was it, in fact? You joined up around about November.
Yes, that's November.
And when did they actually next contact you?
2 weeks beforehand. It's probably the 1st of November. We were called to St. John's Wood, Lord's Cricket Ground.
So what did they tell you to bring with you?
A suitcase. And that was all because you were going to get kitted out, just the clothes you were wearing and a suitcase, and you were kitted out there, and the suitcase to take your other stuff back home, so bring your clothes back home 3 days after you've been here. Well, it's on the other uniform, and you don't need it anymore.
So what happened when you got to Lourdes?
It was this somewhat station, it directed me from St. Lawrence Station. I'd never been in the area before, only to Lourdes Cricket Ground. And I was directed to the creek down, and it wasn't quite so obvious as it is today, and at the wartime maneuvering was disguised as something else. And there was this portal on the gate there, where the chipboard and the chips your name off. You had to report to a particular sector, alphabetical letters up, all those stuff, and they got out, reported stuff. And he said, well, go and sit in the stands. an exact number, so-and-so, and some number of sequence they have there. And you'll be called over the last stages, and you'll be called to assemble before we take you down to where you're going to be safe for the rest of the next 3 weeks. So I went into the stand. The first thing that struck me sitting there was a chap marrying the law, and sitting on a roll, and going back the long cattle of the world, and going back and forth over the ground. I'd never seen any side of the ground before, or a cricket ground, and not like that nature, really. And it fascinated me. And then a loudspeaker announced, so those of you, these are foreign people, will you go into the NAFI that existed then?
Were there many there? I mean, many of you.
Yeah, quite a few, yeah. We were intake number 1, 2, 3, I was married. And so it's only one intake a week. There's probably, a couple of hundred dollars in the morning.
And all in these stands?
All in their sets in the stand. And then they divide us into groups of about 20 or 30 to easily convey us. It's all going to the NAFI. We'll give them an identity. You're in group number so and so, a data set sort of identity. When you hear an announcement, you do whatever they say. We go to NAFI, have a cup of tea, and we're in touch with you again. So the NAFI was the. Now, one of the balconies, I mean, I'm not thinking about the law school ground, but there's the balcony up where the crew sometimes come out, and that was the NAFI. And someone told me it was the Lord's Tavern, but it wasn't that. The tavern was next door to it, really. But it was, well, I went and sat in the balcony where we come out and sit out there, and the first person I spoke to was a Scotsman. I'd never even met a Scotsman in my life before. And I said, "Where's the company that said place there?" It's a long way. I never had that chance at work, but I never had this guy. The Scotsman was a foreigner, as far as I was concerned. We were friends for quite a long while afterwards, in various different places. And then our names were called out in group number, and we would report at the entrance. Now, we were going to march you down to the place you'll be staying, which was Viceroy Court in wherever the road is, just along by St John's Wood there. I forget the name of the road, but it's just Viceroy Court. And we got into this group, because out of the 20 or 30 of us in the group, about half had been in the ATC and couldn't march, and the other half couldn't, so it was a bit of a shambles sitting there. We weren't all supposed to be able to march, just wanted to walk in a couple hours down the road. We came to this luxurious block of flats and taken over by the others, like most of them in the area had been. And there we were, in 10 of us, in a room about this size, and three bunks in three-tier bunks, and one of the bed by itself. And we're given a room number, again, room number 10 or whatever it was. And we had this business of visiting us on the top one. And I was chosen to do that thing. I didn't have the room on the top of them, so I got to the top of one of these things, and I got the car, this is pretty awful. But the bathrooms were pitch-nail walls. No, pitch mirrors all around the world, completely glass all the way around, these mirrors all the way around. The luxurious bath was by that time, there's no water coming out of the taps around the bath itself. They didn't shut off. The lifts were out of action permanently because they thought that was a hazard of the wartime. Get stuck in the lift and all that. And so there's a very lonely place for, I think, so there was flights of stairs that went down each time. And you've got this classic, there's no car down the stairs. All that was stripped out, of course. And no less east in the building itself. We had to go to what is now, I think, it was a garage just down the road from there, where from an underground, they had an underground sector there. The top part of the garage that is now was the clothing.
That's where you were kitted out first.
Kitted out there, and underneath was the where the mess hall was. With all these benches and tables and a big tank of filthy water where you washed your hands, which were given straight away. They didn't have them there before you got your uniform.
So what was your impression of RAF food then there?
Well, pleasantly surprised, actually. I never thought it was rotten anywhere, but it always struck me as being good. Whether it varied in different places, of course, and but generally I found it very healthy, and well, that was concerned, anyway. I didn't have any problems at all.
Enough of it?
I said,
enough of it?
Okay, so, yes, that was much, much more than I could normally eat, really. But it was no problem. And some people went back and had more if they wanted it, if they felt inclined to give you more, but quite often they refused. There's some couple of days or three, 8 days or whatever. But it was quite reasonable for nothing too gas. Except once or twice, you get phases when you have enough cheese on toast that you can put up with, really. So you have a few complaints in that direction.
So boredom more than anything else.
That's right, yeah. It was plain stuff. But one thing that was always said, the tea was so good. I don't know whether that was what they put in it historically or whether it was naturally good. Oh, it was. You've got an average Japanese tea now, of course, not normally at one like this size. And the tea was always seems to be right.
Now, what about the kitting out upstairs then?
The kitting out, that was the first day we had to settle ourselves in there. We were in these bunks, and the question came, should we change into pajamas, or what do we do? You know, we're all looking at each other, really wondering. We gave them a pillow stuffed with straw, which made your ear go in a peculiar shape, and you gave them a couple of blankets, and that was it. You didn't get to the sheet stage there, you did raise it on, but you didn't at that point. And there's the next day, you'll go for your uniforms tonight, you stay here. But nothing else to do that day. Oh, the first thing we had to do was make dog tags for ourselves. We were given two plastic discs, one which dissolves in water, and one doesn't, and one burns and doesn't. And we were given some tools, embossing tools, and we had to really have them. And that's what somebody else and then marking up these discs. And every now and again, we were assembled for some talk or the other, or some introduction to something. The cinema, you went there, that sort of thing. Or went to another block of flats down the road where they kissed out as some activity. And they went to make this dog test. That was the first bit of kit they got, but they were a bit round your neck and a string or whatever, and these two things stuck on there. And I found definitely doing something. And so some chap there said, I was a bit for you, so I was a bit of cobbler, I know how to do all this sort of stuff. And so suddenly there's all these chaps, all these different occupations, there's a chap there who said, I can't be called up now, I'm an artist, I work in the theatre. He said, I cannot be called up, it's spoiling my career. So he said, well, it might spoil your career, so in other words, be careful. Anyway, he wanted to go on more to third service so he could go back to the theatre. Anyway, so we got his dog tags then. Next morning, we marched down to the kitting out place, which was like a self-service restaurant, really, in a way. So it was along a line of people who threw an item of clothing at you and said, that's your size, or what they didn't. But we weren't measured up for clothing. They did it quite well. When I watched Chester, and he said 36 and over, and not 34, and they measured me and said, you're 34, sort of stuff. And I gave the caps a try that on, and I gave another one if it didn't fit. And he went through the various things, signed for each thing as you went on. He suddenly got involved in all the documentation, which he never realised existed. And then gave you an identity card as well, because it wasn't the same thing. $12.50, and that was back before the guard was alive. And you came out with a kit bag of clothing which arrived at some which we've never seen before, really, but that's your fill up. And you were sent back to your accommodation to try to roar and parade outside in the street we were on. That's when you start laughing when you realise that things are not the size they're supposed to be, etc. And at the same time, they're wearing your great coat. What's the difference to ours? And it was the same blue, same everything. But it was a better quality. And I was in some, it's the Royal Canadian Air Force on it. And so it was one that the Canadians had made for the Canadian Air Force, and they should throw it away and go into the. When we had the first inspection, a chap came down and took a look at it and inspected it. He said, that looks different. I'm not sure you can keep that. Anyway, he checked the stores around, but another one that size. So I kept that all my all the time I was after I was commissioned. I got a few of COVID. They looked like an American quality was always better than ours, it seemed. And this was really very super.
Do you remember how many sets of you? Do you remember what you got? I mean,
yeah, I think you got your Esprit, as it was called, with the buttons and the brass buttons and all that. And you got a battle dress.
Blue.
Yes, that was blue. Yeah, I think it was probably two or three shirts. I'm not sure. I think you got two shirts initially, with the promise you'd get another one later on. I think it was something like that. On the call, and two sets of underwear. A cylinder vest and an ordinary vest, the Optisum kit, denims and boots, the ghastly thing that struck terror in your hearts when you had to put that on, the Optisum kit, denims and boots. The boots are probably something that I'm quite used to. You've got a pair of shoes, obviously, Air Force doesn't, outside vest boots, and shoes, not boots. The boots weren't the army type boots, they were rubber soled and not no studs and anything like that. And they were very comfortable, they were getting dug into. And pillow shoes, which were very good, and socks, of course. And it would kiss out. I thought very well, actually. No, you've got two hats, a forage cap, and a pink. And then he took the pink one away from us after this, and I was there for the forage cap because of the white flesh. So I thought, that's only 4 hours, I think, and it's in North, you can't have it. And what else? Kits, yeah, TC kit, but all that. Well, that's why I gave you a razor and a shaving brush and toiletries. No one used them, I don't think. They said they bought their own razors and Rolls Royce or whatever else someone had and all this stuff. So I think some people use that stuff much. And bar soap, no towel, of course. And I don't have two towels. Certainly one towel is full of everything. Well, bars, it's not very big, but very good quality. They're all very good quality stuff, and one can criticize that. And that's all I'm thinking of in the moment. And we could have got flying kit, that was later on, but that issue when we started flying, that's another very great stuff. Well, the kit bag is my only, and all the things we need to carry, really, and it's about the size of them, virtually. Probably about twice the amount of weight. And I always found that a bit of a problem lifting up, so I couldn't lift up very high off the ground. The other one on the shoulder, but that side went down rather dramatically, really. And I coped, I decided I was going to cope, and that was it, really.